Right, if you please take your seats, we'll continue on this afternoon's session. So our next speaker this afternoon is Professor Deborah Mayo, who's in the Department of Philosophy at Virginia Tech. She also holds a visiting appointment at the Center for the Philosophy of Natural and Social Science at the London School of Economics. She is the author of Error and the Growth of Experimental Knowledge, which was the Lakatos Prize winner for the best book written in philosophy of science. And she has more recently authored a book, Error and Inference, Recent Exchanges in Experimental Reasoning, Reliability, and the Objectivity and Rationality of Science. She will be speaking to us today on the topic of, is the philosophy of probabilism an obstacle to statistical fraud busting? Please join me in welcoming Professor Mayo.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. Well, 2013 was dubbed the year of celebrating statistics, but it might well have been called the year of frustration with statistics. Well-worn slogans of how easy it is to lie with statistics have their own slogans. Association is not causation. Statistical significance is not substantive significance. No evidence of risk is not evidence of no risk. And if you torture the data enough, they will confess. Professional manuals and treatises written for popular consumption are rife with exposés of fallacies and foibles. Task forces are organized, cottage industries regularly arise, forms like this one, exposing the lack of replication and all manner of selection and publication bias. The rise of big data might have made cookbook statistics easier, but these fallacies were addressed by the founders of these tools. R.A. Fisher, whose birthday it was just Monday, observed that the political principle that anything can be proved by statistics arises from the practice of presenting only a selected subset of the data available. However, nowadays, we notice, it's the tools that are blamed instead of the abuser. It seems to me we don't so much need scaling up as scaling back many misdiagnoses of what's going wrong. In one sense, it's blatantly obvious what's going wrong. Sufficient finagling may practically predetermine that a researcher's favorite hypothesis gets support, even if it's unwarranted by evidence. If a test procedure has little, if any, chance to find flaws in a hypothesis H, then when it doesn't find any, it scarcely is in H's favor. I mean, the hypothesis H might have been said to pass the test, but it's a test that has little or no stringency or severity. This requirement here of severity, that if the data agree with the hypothesis, but the method would have probably have issued such a good fit, even if the hypothesis is false, then the data don't count. They're not good evidence, they're poor evidence. I refer to it as bad evidence, no test, dent. And this seems utterly uncontroversial. And I argue that the central role of probability in statistical inference is severity, stringency, call it what you like. It's assessment and control. And I'll call methods that scrutinize a test capabilities according to their severity an error statistical account. Now, existing error probabilities, be they confidence levels or significance levels, may but need not provide severity assessment. And the difference in justification and interpretation called for when you think about severity does require some new name, which is just as well, because existing names, frequentist, sampling theory, Gasharian, Neyman, Pearson, are really all associated with hard line views and we need a fresh approach. To the error statistician, the list that I started out with is less a list of embarrassments than it is a list of key features to be recognized by any adequate account. The criticisms are really all unified by a call to block the two easy claims for evidence that are formalized in error statistical logic. So it seems to me you either grant the logic, and see if this works, or deny the criticism. In this sense, error statistics is error or self-corrected. Are philosophies about science at all relevant here? Well, they should be, because we're talking about questions of the nature of evidence and uncertainty, and philosophers are supposed to care about those things. A critic might protest, you know, there's really nothing philosophical about my criticism of significance tests. The problem is that a small p-value is invariably and erroneously interpreted as giving a small probability to the null hypothesis that the observed difference is mere chance. Really? Well, p-values are not supposed to be used that way. Presupposing that they should or that they must be really stems from a conception of the role of probability in inference, and that conception is philosophical. There are two main views of the role of probability in inference. One is, I call probabilism, to provide a post-data assignment of degree of probability, confirmation, support, or belief in hypothesis. It could be absolute or comparative, such as the Bayesian posterior, Bayes ratio, Bayes boost. The second is that we need probability to ensure long-run reliability of methods, coverage probabilities, control of the relative frequency of errors. Maybe I should be by the microphone. I call this performance. But wait a minute. What happened to the goal of scrutinizing bad evidence, no test by severity? Actually, neither probabilism nor performance directly captures it. Good long-run performance is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for avoiding insevere tests. All those problems, selective reporting, cherry-picking, multiple testing, stopping just when the data look good, these aren't problems about long runs. It's that we can't say about the case in front of us that it's done a good job of avoiding the sources of misinterpretation. In other words, we're really interested in this third use of probability to ensure the control and assessment of how severely hypotheses have passed. We can call that probativeness, so we've got the three P's. Probabilism, by contrast, is linked to a philosophy that says a hypothesis H isn't justified unless it's true or probable or increases probability or makes it firmer, whereas error statistics, this probativism ideal, says that H is not justified unless something's been done to prove the ways we can be wrong about it. And here we have, I think, the third reference to Charles Peirce, one of my heroes. My work is seen as extending and reinterpreting frequent error statistical methods to reflect this severity rationale. And note that the severity construal really does blend testing and estimation, but I'm going to keep to the testing talk here to underscore the probative demand. Capabilities, methods to probe errors are altered, not just by the cherry picking and multiple testing, ad hoc adjustments, but also via data-dependent stopping rules. Imagine this well-known case, two-sided normal testing. Keep sampling until you're able to reject the null at some chosen like 0.05 level. If you didn't find a way to stop in the first 10 trials, researcher goes on to 20, 30, and so on, until eventually getting a 1.96 standard deviation unit corresponding to the 5% significance. And it can be shown that this is a proper stopping rule. With probability one, it will stop. However, if we were to evaluate the actual significance level here, it's going to differ from and be much greater than the 0.05 that would have been operative with the fixed sample size. This is the difference between nominal and actual significance level. However, Jimmy Savage, subjective Bayesian, audaciously declared that optional stopping is no sin. So the problem must be significance levels because they record a difference. Savage says, the likelihood principle emphasized in Bayesian statistics implies that the rules governing when data collection stops is irrelevant to data interpretation. Moreover, and here's another famous paper by Edward Lindman and Savage, this irrelevance of stopping rules restores simplicity and freedom to statistical inference that had been lost with the classical emphasis on significant levels. The formal correlate at this point is the likelihood principle. Now, I claim that the acceptability of methods that declare themselves free of error probability complexities has a lot to do with the growth of today's fallacious statistics, which leads Neyman and Pearson to say, you know, a likelihood ratio is fine as a measure of fit, but we always have to go beyond that. A knowledge of likelihoods alone is not adequate to ensure control of erroneous fits, in other words. And the key difference is that likelihoods fix the actual outcome. While error statistics always considers outcomes other than the one observed, even after the data are in front of you, that's the only way to assess the error properties of the method. So LP, the likelihood principle, entails the irrelevance of and no control over error probabilities, as Alan Birnbaum shows. Berge and Wolpert, in their famous book called The Likelihood Principle, say it seems very strange that a frequentist could not analyze a given set of data if the stopping rule is not given. Data should be able to speak for itself. But for our debunker, data no more speak for themselves in the case of stopping rules than they do with cherry picking, hunting for significance, and the like. It's ironic, by the way, that we hear frequentists tell us only the probability of the data given the hypothesis, because in fact, we never look just at the likelihood, because we reject the likelihood principle and always go on to the error probabilities. The same standpoint that data speak for themselves tends to downplay the importance of experimental design. Here's Lucien Lacan a while ago saying, one of the claims of the Bayesian approach is the experiment matters little. What really matters is the likelihood function after experimentation. This tends to undo what classical statisticians have been preaching for many years. Think about your experiment. Design it the best you can. Take all sorts of precautions against selection bias and subconscious prejudice. But the many criticisms that we hear about statistical significance tests tend to overlook the fact that these methods don't work apart from design of experiments, nor apart from validating the model assumptions, whether it's actually experimental or an observational inquiry. But in fact, no methods do. Reports now trickling in about the consequences of ignoring frequentist principles of design of experiments aren't too surprising. Here's Stanley Young from National Institute of Statistics saying there's a relatively unknown problem with microarray experiments in addition to the multiple testing problems. Until relatively recently, he says, the microarray samples were not sent through assay equipment in random order. And as a result, essentially all the microarray data prior to 2010 is unreliable. And I've heard this from a few sources. The problem is not with the p-value methodology, but the design and conduct of the study. Here's Lambert of one of the bioinformatics software companies saying, stop ignoring experimental design or my head will explode. He says, statisticians tell them how they're never asked to help with the design before the experiment, only to clean up the mess afterwards. At least this is in the last 20 years. We know from R.A. Fisher, again, that to consult the statistician after an experiment is finished is often merely to ask him to conduct a post-mortem examination, that is, to say what the experiment died of. But you need a rationale for the kinds of design of experiments. They must make a difference and be called for by the methods. And again, the probabilistic account lacks this, and it's once again the same culprit, the looking at the conditional data. This may step on days and toes. I'll let Larry Wasserman say it, though, when he says that randomized experiments, permutation tests, cross-validation, data splitting, these are unabashedly frequentist ideas, and while one can strain to fit them into a Bayesian framework, they don't really have a place in Bayesian inference. Now, the next thing has to do with testing statistical assumptions. All methods of statistical inference rest on statistical models, and I think that our statistical philosophy and methodology should be rich enough to be able to deal with this. Typically, a Bayesian account will assume the model either as reflecting subjective beliefs or backgrounds. The most popular probabilists these days, though, are conventionalist Bayesians, where priors are actually supposed to have the least influence on the inference. And some of these conventionalist Bayesians call themselves objective Bayesians or O Bayesians because they only assume the statistical model and the data, saying that they're just as objective as frequentists because they assume the same thing. But the thing is, error statisticians don't assume the model. We always test them. This from a paper by Cox and me, that an important part of frequentist theory is the ability to check models. And the way it works is the use of statistics whose distribution doesn't depend on the model assumption to be checked is what allows the frequentist to split off this task using a residual.
Just talking about objective Bayesians here?
Yeah. The fullest description, really, of testing assumptions is the work of my colleagues, Araspanos, with whom I've been working with, too. George Botts, a hero to many modern Bayesians, issues a plea for ecumenism in statistics. Why? Because he denies that Bayesian updating can serve for model checking. It's really the checking that leads him to this ecumenism. Why? He says, because we have to set out all the models, M1, M2, et cetera, and compute posterior probability for each one. The difficulty, Bach says, with this approach is that by supposing all possible sets of assumptions are known a priori, it discredits the possibility of new discovery. But new discovery is, after all, the most important object of the scientific process. That's Bach. This open-endedness is crucial, yet it's precluded if you need to have a probabilistic measure over an exhaustive group of hypotheses. One model, MI, might be given a high posterior probability relative to the other models considered, overlooking the model that's actually produced the data. Box notes in the same paper. However, testing assumptions involves examining residuals from a model, and again, this violates the likelihood principle. And Casella and Berger point out that to test assumptions, you need to examine residuals. Residuals are not based on sufficient statistics, and so they say it violates the likelihood principle. You might want to say it's just not operative there. But look, if you're violating the likelihood principle for testing assumptions, why not for the primary inference? Is that really coherent to say you have to uphold the likely principle in one case and not the other? It turns out that those much vilified pure significance tests, no alternative, are the primary means for testing model assumptions. Typically here, the null hypothesis H0 would be the assertion that the assumptions hold for the data. Graphical analysis combined with parametric and non-parametric methods are usually combined. And equally important is to evaluate the effects of violations on error probability assessments for some subsequent inquiry. So the error statistical methodology offers a kind of interconnected account of piecemeal steps that link the substantive question, the statistical inference, and the underlying model generating and checking the data. we don't need an exhaustive list of hypotheses to split off the problem of how well or poorly probed a given hypothesis is. We don't need that Bayesian catch-all factor, everything other than age. And Ephra has recently pointed out it's this piecemeal aspect that is a key asset of the frequentist approach. Within a probability model, we may deductively assign probabilities to an exhaustive set of events. That's different. But the statistical hypotheses are not themselves events. They may allow predicting events, explaining events. They may be claims about data generating mechanism, often put in terms of parameters in models. And we need an account that affords a genuinely inductive, not purely deductive, inference to such claims about hypotheses. Take the case we heard about earlier already from Ken Staley's discovery of the Higgs, announcing that we have strong evidence for a standard model Higgs, July 2012. Physicists didn't assign a high probability to this hypothesis, call it H star, that a standard model Higgs exists, whatever that might mean. Besides, many actually believe in beyond the standard model physics, and they wouldn't assign a high probability to this. They expect violation. But what is it they want? They want to ensure that before announcing the hypothesis H star, that an SM Higgs boson has been discovered, that it has been given a severe run for its money, that with high probability, they would have observed a smaller excess of signal-like events if the universe really were one where everything is due to background alone. So very probably, the null hypothesis would have survived. Okay? A whole cluster of tests fortified with much cross-checking in different labs if, in fact, it were true that mu is zero. So there's a high probability, and it's certainly not being given to the hypothesis, but something like this, that the test would have produced less than the 5 sigma under the assumption that the null hypothesis H naught is true. And it's something like 0.999997. With probability 0.99997, our methods would show the bumps disappear, as so often occurs in high energy physics, under the assumption the data are due to the background. Assuming that we want a posterior probability, I suggest, it seems to be a slide from the value of knowing this probability is high and the importance of that for understanding the warrant for H star. And granted, though, this relies on an implicit severity principle of evidence that I'm talking about, where they will say that the data provide good evidence or excellent evidence for hypothesis to the extent that that hypothesis has passed severely, that probably its denial would have survived if it were false. So they quantify then, moving on to various properties of the particle, inferring ranges of magnitudes using confidence intervals, etc. But what do we find in practice, the p-value police? Again, this is something Kent mentioned. Leading Bayesian Dennis Lindley had this letter sent around to the ISBA, International Society for Bayesian Analysis. Why are they demanding such a strong evidence? Are they so wedded to frequentist methods, Lindley asked? If so, has anybody tried to explain what bad science this is? I thought it was a joke when I first saw this letter coming around on the day that everybody else was celebrating. Other critics rushed in to examine if reports by journalists and scientists were misinterpreting the sigma levels as posterior probability assignments to the model. Many critics were claiming that the 0.999 I mentioned was fallaciously being assigned to the hypothesis H star itself. What they're really doing is interpreting a legitimate error probability as if it were an H star. It's not the scientists who were erring, or so I argue. granted, once you have this strong evidence for the Higgs, we might, in ordinary informal English, say, so probably we've really experimentally demonstrated the Higgs. But that's very different. So when you hear what they really wanted are posterior probabilities, you should ask, well, how are we to interpret the priors that would go into that, and what about the posteriors? It turns out that the probabilist finds himself holding an account with very murky, undefined terms. They will rarely tell you what they're talking about when it comes to priors. Very hard to pin them down. Subjectivists feel that their priors reflect degrees of belief, opinions, actual or rational, betting behavior, and for a long time it was thought that only subjective Bayesianism had a shot at legitimate philosophical foundations. But nowadays, subjective elicitation has largely been abandoned, but we still hear things like all methods are subjective, or all methods are equally subjective and objective, and that's another thing you should query. I mean, it's one thing to say statistical models are strictly false, that's Box again, that they are objects of belief, okay, but that's quite another thing to convert the entire task to modeling beliefs. This is a shift from phenomena to epiphenomena, as Clark Gleamore called it. It seems to me that our statistical inference philosophy should be in sync with scientific inference more generally. And science more generally learn about phenomena. The models are imperfect, all right, but they're not just learning about beliefs about the phenomena. And they certainly don't set sail by assigning degrees of belief to an exhaustive set, even if they have these informally. That doesn't get mixed in with the data analysis. And as a matter of fact, physicists believe in some kind of a Higgs before building that big, expensive collider. That's very different than having evidence for a specific discovery of the various properties. The most popular Bayesianism or probabilism these days is non-subjective. Conventional seems to be the term that they like when I offered it, or default, or reference. So what's a prior there? Well, it's told to us that it's an undefined mathematical construct for obtaining posteriors. That's what it does. Some give highest weight to the data, some satisfy invariance, others match frequentive. The conventionalist priors are not intended to even be beliefs, they're often improper. Some suggest that these objective or conventional priors are really just a stopgap measure until you have beliefs. A small group of Bayesians, following George Box again, propose to include the prior as part of the model. Then you will be able to test it, they claim. They're very unhappy with the idea of Bayesians not testing their model, so they say, let's put it together with the rest of the model and test it along with assumptions like independence, distribution. But how do you test something if you don't have an idea of its intended meaning? I don't mind that its meaning shifts in different problems, but for the case at hand, we need to know. So-called Duhemian problems of where to lay the blame for anomaly would loom large. And what about this business of going back and fixing the prior after seeing the data in order to get things cleaned up? Maybe it's the independence, maybe it's the distribution. Should we really be going back and sort of double counting the data? I'm not saying, by the way, priors never work. They do often. But when they do, they occur within ordinary frequentist probability assessment. And perhaps the last talk was an example of that. Empirical Bayes, or just ordinary frequentism, really. We all have a Bayes theorem and the definition of conditional probability. True, p-values and other statistical methods can be misused. I'm saying they needn't be. And when they are, this is detected only thanks to the fact that they have the means to register formally those problems in the list that I began with. In other words, far from ensuring a high capacity to have alerted us to curb our enthusiasm, it's true various gambits make it easy to send out enthusiastic signals erroneously. This is a failure for sure, but don't trade them in for methods that can't detect failure at all. It's interesting that fraud-busting tools, some are formal, some are informal, rely on error statistical reasoning and explicit error statistical methods, Simonson statistical forensics, as he calls it, busted Smeester's not so long ago in social psychology. I find it ironic that criticisms of significance tests and confidence intervals often chime in with the fraud busting, even if that's based on methods that the critics themselves purport to reject. Is there a whiff of inconsistency here or schizophrenia among that? It seems to me that if you think p-values are untrustworthy, how can you take them as legitimating criticisms of fraud, especially when they are of the career-ending sort? So p-values can't be trusted, I say, except when used to argue that p-values can't be trusted. When we hear that there's statistical evidence of some unbelievable claim, last week it was distinguishing shades of gray and being politically moderate, some probabilists claim, you see, if our beliefs were mixed into the data, into the interpretation of the evidence, we wouldn't be fooled. We know these things are unbelievable. That could work in some cases, though it still wouldn't show what they've done wrong. And it wouldn't help with our most important problem, which is how to distinguish tests of one and the same hypothesis with different methods. Maybe one uses searching or post-data subgroups, another without. Simons, Nelson, and Simonson point out how much additional flexibility there is if you are using Bayesian rather than frequentist approaches. Moreover, we see something, I guess, not so surprising among members of committees who are investigating questionable research. They find that the researchers really believe their hypothesis. Richard Gill, a friend who has played the role as statistician investigating potential fraud, asked the question, is it integrity or fraud, or just questionable research? He says, probably so-and-so's data has been obtained by the usual questionable research practices so prevalent in the field in question. Everyone does it this way. In fact, if you don't, you never get anything published. Effects are too small, etc. People aren't deliberately cheating. They honestly believe in their theories, and they're just doing their best to make it clear. And of course, a lot of these committees started after the Diederik Stoppel fraud case, where he simply collected no data at all, but they found the practices so hair-raising among the rest of the field that they kind of wondered if everybody wasn't almost as bad as if they didn't bother to collect data. And I have no reason to doubt what Richard Gill says. It seems to me, though, if he's right, that the only way to get published in this field is via questionable science, then these inquiries really are pseudoscientific. They shouldn't be doing a statistical analysis purporting to link the data and scientific claims. On the other hand, if they're offered a subjective Bayesian calculation, a high posterior, given the data, may be readily had. It seems to me that the onus should be on the researcher to show that their methods have been subjected to scrutiny, that they have self-criticized. So here I offer a kind of definition of questionable science. A statistical or any other inference is questionable if it stems from a method with little, if any, ability to have found flaws, even if they existed. A research area that regularly falls into the questionable science category and fails to be able to vouchsafe the capability of discerning or reporting or admitting mistakes I'll call pseudo-song. And I may label an account there more readily than some others, but this is the idea. It's really useless to apply statistical methods if you can't show even that what you're measuring is relevant to the inference. So I really think one needs to worry about mistakes at the level of data, at the level of statistical model, and also linking the statistical inference with the substantive claim. Either go develop some theory or call what you're doing something else. It could still be of human interest, and so on. And on this view, it may be that many of those artificial experiments, questionnaires, and undergraduates should be scrapped. It seems to me what's really important isn't so much replication we always hear about, but triangulation. Here, it's ensured that if one analysis doesn't find a mistake, others will, at least with high probability. Sometimes when we hear I've replicated, it really means once again, I was able to find a way to construe my data as evidence of the effect. In my own work, I certainly don't ignore misinterpretations and misuses of statistical methods. In fact, my main part of my work, is dealing with them. So first, we have fallacies of rejection, mixing statistical and substantive. One way would be to immediately go from statistical significance to substantive. And this is handled easily with severity because flaws in the substantive alternative haven't been probed by the statistical test. And so that substantive claim fails to pass. And here is Neil and Mahler who says, merely refuting the null is too weak to corroborate the substantive claim. We have to have Papparian risk, severe test, excites me, or something like Salmon's highly improbable coincidence. So-called null hypothesis significance tests that allow this immediate move really only exist as abuses of tests and not really licensed by any legitimate testing. The second variant on a fallacy of rejection is inferring a discrepancy from the null beyond what it warrants. It need not be indicative of a large discrepancy at all, especially with large N, the large N problem. But here, too, severity makes short work of this because an alpha significant difference is indicative of less of a discrepancy from the null the higher the sample. Think about this. What's more indicative of a large effect, let's say, it's of a fire alarm that goes off with burnt toast, or one that's so insensitive that it doesn't go off unless the house is fully ablaze. The large sample size is like the one that goes off with burnt toast. It's the insensitive one that indicates big fire. It also comes in the form of the Jeffries-Good-Lindley paradox. With n sufficiently large, a statistically significant result can correspond to a high posterior probability to a null, provided you give the null a lump of a prior. They call it a spike prior. But why use that? And why compare the error probability with the posterior probability anyway? Then the other side, the fallacy of non-significant result. The test might not be sensitive enough. This is one of the slogans in my initial list. No evidence against the null is not evidence for the null. True. Negative results don't warrant zero discrepancy from the null, but we can use severity to set an upper bound, as we similar to what we do with confidence intervals, to infer the discrepancy from zero isn't as great as some discrepancy gamma. And of course, what counts as substantively important is a context-dependent question. Now, many people say they try to get people to interpret error probabilities correctly. They tried to get people to interpret p-values correctly. It didn't work, and they are in favor of banning them altogether. And I want to be clear, it's not a matter of my being a fan of significance tests. They're just a part of a larger methodology of error probability methods. What we see with many confidence intervals, CI reformers, use tests in the same dichotomous fashion that they supposed to be again. So with respect to this, I've tried. At first I thought, well, they tried. But then an amazing thing happens when you look at the textbooks and papers of these authors. P-values, they tell us, don't give rise to posterior probabilities and hypotheses, which is what you want, so you can use them, but only by misinterpreting them. Or they're perfectly fine if the model is infallibly given and you only care about good performance in the long run. Or they're perfectly fine if the significance level matches your degree of belief in the hypothesis, as with certain uninformative priors. Or they're fine if you deny that any background knowledge should ever enter inference. And I really mean, although I'm not naming names here quite deliberately, but they say these. And these are the middle of the roaders. There's a new paradigm, science-wise error rates, false discovery rates, which I won't get into in any detail, but it combines probabilism and performance, but in ways that I fear risk entrenching just about every fallacy in the book. But if we imagine two-point hypothesis, H0 and H1, and then H1 is identified with some meaningful effect, H star, everything else is ignored. If we assume that the probability of that meaningful effect is very small, like 0.1, if we permit a dichotomous thumbs up or down pronouncement from a single, just 0.05 significant result, ignoring the magnitudes, and if the ratio of a type 1 error probability to the power is used to supply a kind of likelihood ratio in a quasi-Bayesian analysis, then the unsurprising result is most positive results are false. But these computations might at best hold for a very crude screening exercise for association between genes and diseases, and this is not the bulk of science. And these numbers are just made up, by the way. Okay. Concluding remarks, I think there is a need for a new foundation. I worry that just when there's a move to raise consciousness about questionable statistics, some may buy into methods that sacrifice the very thing that is doing the work in the criticism. Error statistical methods include all of resampling, statistics, causal modeling, model specification, not limited to some of the hokey tests you sometimes see. There are some positive signs, fortunately. Some of the worst offenders are now taking very serious steps to demand authors report how flexible they've been, they say. And there's a lot of push to register trials and so on. Now, I used probabilism in my title because we are starting to see some, I'm calling them error statistical Bayesians, for lack of a better term, who are also rejecting probabilism. So, for example, in an attempted meeting of the minds between a Bayesian and an error statistician, Gelman and Shalizi, Shalizi being the error statistician, claimed that implicit in the best Bayesian practice is a stance that has much in common with the error statistical approach, even though that's frequentist. Indeed, crucial parts of Bayesian data analysis, such as model checking, can be understood as error probes. But this is, I think, a very unique and rare position. But the idea of error statistical foundations for Bayesian tools is not as preposterous as it might seem. The very concept of severe testing is sufficiently general to apply to any of the methods now on offer. After all, any inference can be said to be warranted or unwarranted just to the extent that it has or has not withstood severe testing. I agree further with that when they say in the rejoinder there have been technical advances and now we need an advance in philosophy, and I agree. And in order to promote debunking and fraud busting, it should be error statistical. So that's my talk, that's just an overview.
Questions?
Oh, I guess I guess you were first, but I don't know your name.
Oh,
okay.
This is really fascinating. One thing you have not mentioned is Fisher's fiduciary inference. How do you view fiduciary inference in this context?
How do I view fiduciary?
Yeah.
It's funny you ask that. I want to know how you view them, because I think you wrote something about it. The fiducial idea from Fisher is this mystery that nobody really thinks they understand. So I think it would be dangerous for me to, you know, suggest, although I do sometimes have a sneaking feeling, especially as I talk to David Cox, that maybe Fisher did have in mind a notion like severity. And if you look at the idea of a fiducial, I can't believe these are unrehearsed remarks, but if you do look at the meaning of a fiducial measurement, it really does mean something like a benchmark, a calibration point. And so it is possible that he had something like that in hand, but I do think it's dangerous given all the people who tried to interpret Fisher over the years. Don't you think?
If we actually heard the term in aerostatistics, we're thinking that Kelly and I, we are working on trying to understand it more. It's a dangerous adventure, but we're trying.
Really want to hear about
it.
So what did Nate Silver do right?
And did I speak about him?
No.
Okay.
But the point was that, is this the jelly bean notion? That is, if you have a lot of different entities and they are all predicting the same things, that you will get the right result. Isn't that what Nate Silver did?
No. Are you talking about the fact that if you keep searching, that in fact the probability is high that you'll find at least one anomaly, significant result?
No, the point is, how did he predict every single election?
Oh, please. Really off topic. No, I mean, I hear that actually he just took the things from the existing poll, mm-hmm. and that there
That's
was nothing
right.
remarkable, and that his success rate. You know, I don't really want to get into that. But if you want to know what I think he said wrong, he got up in front of the joint statistical meetings and said, oh, by the way, and I want to say that I think that we should be Bayesian, because I think that people are so biased that, he was really talking about journalists, that they ought to report their biases. Well, if you think people are so biased, it would be good if they reported their biases, but you wouldn't want them to mix it in with the data, would you? The difference between taking account of biases and blending the biases in with the data analysis so that you can't discriminate them. So I always think there's a difference between being aware of and taking precautions against biases and actually using the biases. So that's what I would say about Nate with respect to anything I really am an expert on. I don't want to say anything about his polls. And I think he's good at sports casting also.
There are no further questions. We're already behind, so let's thank our speaker again for a stimulating talk.